Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 232. It's Monday, October 16th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, why don't we get started with a couple abortion-related stories. First up, from the Ohio Capital Journal, in Ohio, black women get abortions at a much higher rate. There are six times as many white women as black women in Ohio. Yet last year, black women had more abortions. The wild disparity in other data in the most recent state abortion report suggests that economics plays a huge role in women's decisions about whether to abort a pregnancy. The economic impacts of pregnancy and abortion might be considerations for Ohioans as they go to the polls on November 7th to vote on Issue 1, an amendment that would enshrine reproductive rights in the state constitution. That women have to juggle considerations of pregnancy, poverty, and survival is hardly new, and it's not hard to see how economics might play a role in the vast disparity between abortions among black Ohio women and their white counterparts. Nearly one in four unmarried mothers live in poverty, and black women are more than twice as likely as white women to live in poverty, 23% versus 9%. Still, last year, in Ohio, the number of women who were already mothers who got abortions was nearly double the number who had no children. About 11,600 women who were already mothers got abortions, and about 6,300 women who had no children got an abortion. So this has been true nationally as well, that actually black women, and particularly black mothers, are actually the most common, the highest likelihood to get an abortion. It's not a bunch of young single people running around. It's access to contraceptive, and it's access to the whole range of health care, including abortion. And another story in the changing landscape of abortion in the United States, this from Politico. Pharmacies begin dispensing abortion pills. A handful of independent pharmacies across the country have quietly begun dispensing the abortion pill mifepristone under new rules created by the Biden administration earlier this year, even as a looming Supreme Court case could reimpose restrictions or ban the drugs entirely. Thousands of branches of major pharmacy chains are poised to join them, making the drugs more accessible to millions of people nationwide and kicking off a new phase of the legal and political battle over the most popular method of ending a pregnancy. Most of the first pharmacies certified to dispense the drug are in states with legal protections for abortion in general, and the pills in particular, including California, Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington. But some are in states with near-total bans, like Texas, and in states that cut off access early in pregnancy, including South Carolina, which has a 6-week prohibition, and Arizona, which has a 15-week ban. The abortion laws in Wisconsin, where one pharmacy is certified to dispense, remain in legal limbo. Several factors, however, are likely to keep the pills out of reach for many. The country's largest pharmacy chains told Politico that they will not sell the drugs for now in states where GOP attorneys general have threatened legal action, or in states where abortion is legal but pharmacists' ability to dispense the pills falls into a legal gray area. Many conservative-led states have also banned or placed curbs on the pills, and efforts by doctors and drug makers to topple those restrictions have, so far, failed in court. And in states with legal protections, many individual pharmacies and pharmacists are refusing to dispense because of personal objections to abortion, a desire to avoid protesters, or the hoops they must jump through to become eligible to dole out the medication. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and other medical and advocacy groups have called on the Biden administration to drop the certification requirement on the pills, which would have allowed pharmacies to begin dispensing them like any other prescription drug earlier this year. A wave of recent shield laws allows doctors in California and other blue states to prescribe and mail the drugs to patients in states with anti-abortion laws, and more virtual clinics have opened since Roe fell, some of which will mail the medication anywhere in the U.S. regardless of state restrictions. I suspect over the long run that a lot of this will be by mail, says Alina Selganakakoff, the director of the Women's Health Policy Program at Kaiser Family Foundation, a health policy think tank. There's a stigma we still have around going into a pharmacy. Some patients may be uncomfortable, especially if you live in a rural area where you may know the clerks and people working there, so it may not be an option for you. But supporters of broader access argue pharmacies still have a crucial role to play, particularly because abortions can be time sensitive. People might not be able to wait for the drugs to arrive by mail, either because they experience a miscarriage, their pregnancy is threatening their health, or because they're in a state that bans abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Others may not have a reliable mailing address or may live with an abusive partner. Also, hanging over the rollout of the drugs to pharmacy shelves is a court case that could reinstate previous rules that only doctors can dispense the pills or strip FDA approval of the medication altogether. The Biden administration and Danko recently appealed to the Supreme Court to overturn a lower court ruling that would ban pharmacy dispensing and mail delivery of mifepristone and impose other restrictions. The Supreme Court is expected to hear the case in either 2024 or 2025. Okay, well, abortion certainly classifies as a very politically divisive issue in this country, but there's also an underlying public health issue that undergirds political divisiveness. This from Axios. Mental health key to healing political divisiveness. Surgeon General Murthy says rebuilding social connection has to be a national priority. The issue of mental health is fundamentally impacting the fabric of society, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said during a recent event hosted ahead of World Mental Health Day. Why it matters? Political divisiveness, climate change, COVID, gun violence, and social media are among stressors taking a simultaneous toll on mental health, which in turn fuels more harmful behaviors. Nearly 40% of Americans rated their mental health as only fair or poor toward the end of last year, according to the American Psychiatric Association. Many workers remain dissatisfied with the way workplace issues, including burnout, are handled by their employers. We have become professionals at putting masks on and walking around society, like everything is going fine, Murthy said during the second ever gathering of all living former and current U.S. Surgeon Generals. But what it betrays is the reality that a lot of people are walking around suffering. Part of the reason people hide their struggles is because culturally we think being successful means being independent, said Murthy. But evolution reminds us that the hunter who worked alone got eaten by a predator or starved to death, he added. The big picture? Murthy has made it a priority to combat loneliness in the U.S. and sees isolation as key to driving political polarization. It's hard to hate people up close, he said. Our connection to one another is a foundation on which we build a healthy society. As that foundation has crumbled and weakened, we've seen that we're suffering across the board. And that's why I really believe that rebuilding social connection in America, the social fabric of our country, has to be a national priority. And the intrigue? Stigma around individual mental health leads some people to self-medicate, which can lead to substance misuse and create psychosis and other health problems, said former U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. So, just an important reminder that human connection is a pillar of human health. Okay, well, next up, I have another story that gets at how human connection is really important to human health. This from Stat News, how kangaroo mother care can help millions of babies each year. More than 1 in 10 infants worldwide are born preterm, many with complications. Nearly 1 million die each year. This is the single largest cause of death in children around the world before their fifth birthday. Thankfully, in recent years, we've learned a great deal about measures that can, collectively, prevent nearly three-fourths of newborn deaths. Key among them is centering mothers and families in the care of their preterm infants. But perhaps the most powerful change we can make to save the lives of preterm infants is to empower mothers and families to provide what's known as kangaroo mother care. This idea runs counter to many contemporary practices, in which preterm babies are often separated from their parents while receiving high-tech intensive care. We now have strong evidence that the mother's ability to provide skin-to-skin contact and breastfeeding through kangaroo care can regulate temperature and breathing, ward off infection, promote breastfeeding and growth, and keep preterm infants alive more effectively than current high-tech strategies. Making prolonged kangaroo mother care, that is more than 8 hours per day, part of routine care for small or sick newborns can prevent up to half of preterm baby deaths by 2025, a Lancet study estimates. Kangaroo mother care also has many benefits for the mother, reducing her risk for hemorrhage after childbirth, promoting bonding with her infant, and improving her mental health by reducing depression and anxiety. The family or partner or other family members and surrogates can also provide skin-to-skin contact. In May, the WHO released a position paper and implementation strategy to enable the expansion of kangaroo mother care around the world. These documents build on the WHO recommendations for kangaroo mother care as the standard of care for preterm and low birth weight babies. WHO also recommends beginning kangaroo mother care immediately after birth, rather than waiting until the infant is stabilized. Immediate kangaroo mother care after birth has been found to increase a low birth weight infant's chance of survival by 25%. Keeping the mother and baby together continuously after childbirth will require changes in infrastructure. For example, accommodating the mother and meeting her needs within special newborn care nurseries, healthcare provider education, teamwork among maternal and newborn care providers, and adapted protocols for integrated care. Additional research is also needed, such as on strategies to increase family participation in the care of their preterm or low birth weight infants in intensive and special care units, and in settings without dedicated newborn units. We also need to know more about the effectiveness of immediate kangaroo mother care from birth for critically ill preterm or low birth weight infants. This includes infants who are mechanically ventilated for respiratory failure or on vasopressor support for management of low blood pressure. These building blocks to center families and keep mothers and newborns together will require significant shifts in investments. However, the potential benefits are even greater: improved infant survival and health, the well-being of families, and the contributions of all these babies that can make to the world in the future. Amen to that. Yes, my friends, human connection is important for human health from the very beginning. Okay, well, next up, a somewhat related story that comes at it from a different angle, really, about human disconnection. This from the Washington Post. The depressing relationship between your job and your odds of drug overdose. Drug overdose deaths in America have doubled since 2015. They've more than quintupled since 2001. As we struggle to understand the risk factors, could we be overlooking jobs? Overdoses killed 163 out of every 100,000 people who usually worked in construction and extraction industries in 2020, whether they were on the job or not, making it by far the most dangerous major occupation drug-wise. Restaurant jobs were second at 118 deaths per 100,000, according to new data from the CDC. What other factors tie them together? We guess education. Occupations with a higher share of workers who earned only a high school diploma or less are more likely to rack up drug deaths, and construction was the lowest share of workers with at least a bachelor's degree at only 7%. That matches other data showing a wide and growing education gap in overdose deaths. In 2015, less educated women and men were 7 and 8 times as likely to overdose as their peers with bachelor's degrees. By 2021, less educated folks of both sexes were 13 times is likely to die from drugs for people aged 25 to 64. From 2015 to 2021, the fatal overdose rate rose an alarming 52% among U.S. men with a bachelor's degree or higher, but it jumped an appalling 151% for men with a high school diploma or less. For women, the increase was 13% among college graduates and 101% for those without college degrees. That observation dumps a square in the path of an onrushing freight train of academic research. Overdoses are often considered, along with suicide and alcoholism, to be deaths of despair. And education and its fellow traveler income has long been understood to be the fulcrum upon which our odds of early death pivot. If you didn't go to college, you're more likely to struggle with everything from colon, liver, and pancreatic cancer to low odds of marriage, more mental distress, and even difficulty socializing. All of these cataclysmic outcomes seem to be deeply entwined with social problems that have accumulated over decades, and probably would just take as long to unpack. But well-off Americans also do drugs. They just aren't nearly as likely to die from them. Less educated folks are 13 times as likely to die of an overdose, but they were only 3 times as likely to have misused opioids in the past month in 2021, according to the National Survey for Drug Use and Health. Why are drugs so much deadlier for the less educated? The share of workers in an occupation who are uninsured correlates even more strongly with its overdose death rate than education. Folks working blue-collar jobs could be both more likely to get injured than their white-collared peers and less likely to get that injury treated by the formal healthcare system. That could lead many to self-medicate. Occupations with the largest rates of overdose also generally are the ones that require a lot of physical mobility or strength. University of Southern California health economist Rosa Lee Pakula said, many workers in these positions develop chronic pain conditions. Chronic pain is a leading reason why people use opioids long-term. And those with long-term use are now facing greater hurdles maintaining access to their opioid prescriptions in light of changing medical recommendations. So they may be more likely to turn to the illegal market. This also explains what we saw when we looked deeper at detailed overdose data for construction jobs. The construction workers most likely to die from drugs are roofers, and roofing is super dangerous. It produced the third most work-related deaths overall of any occupation from 2019 to 2021, only behind fishing, hunting, and logging. When we looked more broadly at the individual detailed occupations in which workers are most likely to die from drugs, whether work-related or not, we saw a similar pattern. Commercial anglers and sailors are even more likely to die of an overdose than roofers by this metric, and forest and conservation workers aren't far behind. So, though the classifications differ slightly, the three occupations that are most dangerous overall are also among the jobs most likely to overdose. But there's more to the story. The education overdose gap widened substantially in recent years, even though these jobs are not growing many times as dangerous. To untangle what's really happened, we called two addiction specialists at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. They explained that the overdose crisis in the area used to follow the classic model. Workers get hurt, receive prescription opioids, run out, turn to heroin, end up with fentanyl. That still happens, said Michael Baca Atlas, a UNC family and addiction medicine specialist who also saw patients at a residential detox unit. But those classic patients are being replaced by younger adults, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, who are trying fentanyl for the first time. These patients haven't progressed their way from pain medicine. They're not following that traditional trajectory that we saw through 2010 to 2015. We're seeing people just straight going to a pressed pill of fentanyl that can be crushed and ingested easily without the complicated steps needed for intravenous drug use. So jobs aren't the defining risk they once were. These new patients often hail from poor, marginalized groups and have had mental health issues since childhood or adolescence. With little contact with the official healthcare system, they turn to street drugs. Fentanyl's potency and availability has thus seized the existing fissures in American society and pushed them wider. The opioid crisis is the wound that exposes these inequities and how hard it is to make it in America, when so much of healthcare and jobs and opportunity, all these advantages are founded for the wealthy. The huge disadvantages faced by certain populations tend to compound one another. That not only explains why overdoses kill less educated Americans at higher rates, but also why they kill Americans more often than folks in comparably wealthy countries. Consider naloxone, the active ingredient in the nasal spray Narcan, which can reverse an overdose in almost miraculous fashion. In a recent analysis of more than 700,000 pharmacy claims, the RAND Corporation found that an American with private insurance paid an average of $28 for the drug in 2014. By 2018, it averaged $35. But if that American didn't have insurance, the average out-of-pocket cost of naloxone soared from $35 in 2014 to $250 in 2018. Today, Narcan is finally available over-the-counter, but it costs $45 for a 2-dose pack, a steep price to pay for struggling humans on the wrong end of America's education divide. Given that a regular fentanyl user can overdose a half dozen times or more in a week, and each overdose can require multiple doses of naloxone, the Narcan bill can really add up. And that's just the cost to put out the immediate fire, that is, the overdose. A lack of insurance also makes it difficult to get the kind of coordinated mental and physical health treatment needed to control an addiction long term. And a lack of insurance, often caused by the loss of a job, is just one of the many causes behind the runaway feedback loop that drives disparities in overdose deaths. According to almost every doctor we spoke with, these deaths are driven in part by the many holes in America's ragged social safety net and the nation's deep economic inequality. These are basically deaths of structural abandonment. These deaths are occurring among the groups of Americans that the system is just not taking care of. And that story perfectly dovetails with this next story from SciTech Daily. Prisons, the unexpected answer to the opioid epidemic. And this is a perfect example of how the most vulnerable populations are called vulnerable for a reason. That when the rug is pulled out from underneath you, these overdose deaths go way up in prison. And getting out of prison is an extremely vulnerable situation. With opioid overdose deaths surging in the United States, many communities are urgently seeking effective solutions. A recent Rutgers-led study has identified strengthening prison reentry programs for the highest-risk users as one of the most promising interventions. For people who use drugs and have been in prison for several years, the reentry period can be chaotic and disoriented, said Grant Victor, an assistant professor at the Rutgers School of Social Work and lead author of the study published in the Journal of Offender Rehabilitation. Closing the healthcare services gap after release, especially for those with psychiatric and behavioral health issues, may improve people's willingness to engage with opioid use treatment, Victor said. Incarceration is a significant risk factor for opioid-related deaths. A 2013 study found the likelihood of a fatal overdose is approximately 129 times greater for someone recently released from prison compared with the general population. Another study led by Victor found that 20% of all opioid-related overdose deaths in one community involved people released from prison within 3 years. Getting the most vulnerable people into a healthcare ecosystem following a release seems to benefit those who are susceptible to opioid overdose. We found that those who were engaged in psychiatric treatment had a higher likelihood of engaging in opioid treatment programs. Given these findings, Victor said state and federal prison systems should consider improving their cascade of care for opioid use, such as implementing standardized screening tools to identify at-risk individuals in prison, and support robust and accessible services when they are released. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my guarantee to you is that if you listen to this show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population, or triple your money back. Okay, well, next up, let's switch to a much bigger context. That would be the public health effects of relying on the petrochemical industry, which produces a lot of chemicals, but also drives climate change and plastic pollution. First up, from The Hill, the U.S. is waking up to the plastic pollution crisis, but is it too late? Too little, too late? Fossil fuels lie at the heart of so many of our biggest climate challenges, and plastic pollution is no exception. Fossil fuels are the basis for 99% of all plastics. The petrochemicals used to produce completely new plastic feedstocks, also known as virgin plastics, account for 8% and 14% of total primary demand for gas and oil, respectively, and will soon become the world's biggest driver of oil demand, ahead of trucks, aviation, and shipping. So it's unsurprising that measures to address plastic pollution put forward by actors with large fossil fuel industries rarely seek to address the real drivers of this environmental crisis: rampant overproduction of virgin plastics and their toxic legacy. Efforts will only scratch the surface if policy fails to tackle the fundamentals of reduction, reuse, and restoration. Virgin plastics are the fastest growing source of industrial greenhouse gases in the world. In that context, downstream measures such as recycling must be coupled with efforts to tackle the root cause of plastic pollution. The U.S. is the world's largest producer of plastic waste, yet its waste management system is unable to keep pace with plastic production. An estimated 2.2 million tons of plastic leaks into the environment each year in the U.S. And in 2016 alone, roughly half of all plastic waste intended for recycling was exported, often to be landfilled, dumped, or burnt, releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Also, large build-outs of petrochemical facilities, such as those planned in Louisiana, Texas, and throughout the Ohio River Valley, risk further poisoning the water and air of marginalized communities living nearby, threatening livelihoods and adding to an already untenable impact on those bearing the brunt of this toxic industry. The planet has just experienced its hottest summer since records began, but if the plastics industry has its way, production will triple by 2050, leading to even more plastic waste and associated emissions at every stage. If the Biden administration is serious about protecting the health of Americans and our planet, the U.S. must join global efforts to tackle the entire life cycle of plastic, from production to least harmful end-of-life treatment. So this story is a really good reminder that even if we cut down on fossil fuels for energy, plastic production is going way up, and also often just ends up being landfilled or burnt. So it also causes climate change pollution, but is obviously leading to a lot of more direct plastic pollution that's a public health threat immediately to human beings and animals and plant environment for that matter. Okay, well, next up, we'll drill down a little bit, no pun intended, to the hospital industry, which is a major user of fossil fuels and fossil fuel pollution. This from undark.org. How U.S. hospitals undercut public health. Healthcare in the United States, the largest industry in the world's largest economy, is notoriously cost inefficient, consuming substantially more money per capita to deliver far inferior outcomes relative to peer nations. What is less widely recognized is that the healthcare industry is also remarkably energy inefficient. In an era of tightening connections between environmental destruction and disease, this widely neglected reality is a major cause behind many of the sicknesses our hospitals treat and the poor health outcomes they oversee. The average energy intensity of U.S. hospitals is more than twice that of European hospitals, with no comparable quality advantage. If U.S. healthcare were its own country, it would rank 11th worldwide in greenhouse gas pollution. If every nation produced an equivalent per capita volume of healthcare emissions, it would immediately consume nearly the entire global carbon budget required to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2030. Without even considering their global impact, air pollution from U.S. emissions accounts for an estimated 77,000 excess deaths annually in the U.S. alone. And according to one 2016 study, emissions from the U.S. healthcare system lead to the loss of more than 400,000 years of healthy life among Americans. This level of harm is commensurate with the tens of thousands of deaths attributable to medical errors each year, around which a massive patient safety movement has been organized in response. But despite these human costs, along with sizable financial costs, there has been no parallel policy movement to address the healthcare industry's role in undermining health through its greenhouse gas emissions. The climate crisis is not just another problem among many. It is instead a meta problem that layers onto countless other problems, exacerbating their consequences for health. Research suggests that particulate matter resulting from burning fossil fuels can damage every organ in the human body. In light of this, efforts to improve public health, healthcare quality, and patient safety without confronting the role of emissions are at best compromised once one accounts for the healthcare industry's substantial contribution to climate crisis that is driving an ongoing and accelerating sixth mass extinction. In addition to the general disaster this presents for global public health, it also constitutes a specific problem for U.S. health policy, as the health harms associated with greenhouse gas emissions disproportionately harm the populations who constitute Medicare and Medicaid's roughly 145 million beneficiaries, including the 30 million patients treated at community-based, federally qualified community health centers. These care systems are meant to protect poor and vulnerable populations, but the means by which they attempt to do so are causing the very harm they seek to address. Consistent with what Ivan Illich described in his 1975 book, medical nemesis, the expropriation of health as cultural iatrogenesis, the phenomenon by which the supposed means of treating disease under capitalist healthcare regimes become not a cure, but rather a cause of the debility it claims to alleviate. What we are seeing now is a form of an environmental iatrogenesis. Largely because of fossil fuel combustion, nearly the entire global population now breathes air that exceeds the World Health Organization's air quality limits. But exposure to unhealthy air and associated health risks are not evenly distributed. In the U.S., Medicare beneficiaries who are 65 years and older and far more likely to suffer chronic lung disease are particularly threatened by bad air quality. This is inseparable from the fact that fossil fuel-related air pollution, the leading environmental cause of human mortality, accounts for 58% of excess annual U.S. deaths. Beyond breathing polluted air, Medicare seniors already compromised by higher incidence of comorbidities are also at greater risk of serious outcomes from climate-related arthropod-borne, food-borne, and water-borne diseases. The climate crisis can exacerbate the spread of over half of known human pathogens, and risk from extreme heat is especially severe. Globally, over the past 20 years, heat-related mortality among seniors has increased by over 50%. Children, 46% of whom are Medicaid beneficiaries, are also especially vulnerable. Fine inhalable particles resulting from burning hydrocarbons, called PM250, that is particles 2.5 micrometers or less in diameter, are particularly harmful because children breathe more air than adults relative to their body weight, giving these particles more opportunity to diffuse into their bloodstreams and throughout their bodies. Research published last year found that climate-related adverse health effects on fetuses, infants, and children include low birth weight, death, hypertension, kidney and lung disease, immune system dysregulation, structural and functional changes to the brain, and a constellation of behavioral and mental health diagnoses. Furthermore, evidence published by UNICEF in 2016 indicates that air polluted by fossil fuels contributes to more than half of the 1 million annual pneumonia deaths worldwide among children age 5 and younger. With respect to racialized and economically dispossessed groups, a study published in 2021 found that racial and ethnic minorities, regardless of income and geographic location, are disproportionately exposed to higher levels of 11 of 14 sources of particulate air pollution. In a United Nations report titled Climate Change and Poverty, Philip Olson concluded that governments have failed to seriously address climate change for decades, and that climate change threatens to undo the last 50 years of progress in development, global health, and poverty reduction. U.S. health officials have often exhibited the same narrow, clinically focused tunnel vision when it comes to healthcare emissions and the climate crisis. Public health's widespread takeover by narrow medical mentalities that sideline root cause analyses and associated policy action is now one of the most pernicious threats to health. Today, it is cheaper to save the climate than continue to destroy it, but federal policymakers and healthcare leaders continue to allow the industry to contribute to the climate crisis, which in turn is harming or killing those who are the most vulnerable. And if not stopped, greenhouse gas emissions could irreversibly undermine the possibility of health for all. Healthcare institutions should take a leading role in implementing immediate change in their own energy use practices. As a core part of their ethical obligation to care, they should also use their enormous lobbying power to demand broader policy action to stop the environmental destruction to which they have been world-leading contributors. Well, folks, that article contained the word for the day, iatrogenesis, which is basically the so-called cure actually becoming a cause of the very thing you're trying to cure. A tip of the hat to capitalism and neoliberalism. Wow. Okay, well, next up, let's get at one attempt to try to rein in some of the petrochemical industry here. This from CNN. California bans 26 possibly toxic cosmetic chemicals. The formulation of some cosmetics may change in a few years due to a new California law banning certain chemicals. California Governor Gavin Newsom has banned 26 chemicals used in many cosmetics such as hair products, body wash, and nail polish due to concerns about health harms. The Golden State's economy is the largest in the United States and the fifth largest in the world, meaning the new law marks another move that could influence the consumer landscape of not only California, but the rest of the nation. Every day, Californians use soap, shampoos, makeup, and other personal care products without realizing that those products could contain chemicals that present serious health risks. The European Union prohibits almost 2,000 chemicals in such products, so this ban on noxious carcinogens and endocrine disruptors is long overdue. The banned chemicals have been linked to various health issues, including cancer, genetic defects, and environmental damage, said Dr. Neil Klein, director of the American Cosmetic Association. California's recent decision to ban cosmetics containing 26 toxic chemicals is a significant win for consumer safety and public health. How cosmetics are regulated. The Environmental Working Group contends that, in the absence of comprehensive federal protection, it falls on states to step up and ensure these harmful substances are absent from our daily routines. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration regulates cosmetics under the 1938 Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, but says products and their ingredients intended to cleanse or beautify, quote, are not subject to FDA pre-market approval except color additives. A pre-market approval application is scientific documentation provided to the FDA to demonstrate the safety and effectiveness of a product or a device. As a result, U.S. President Joe Biden's signing of the 2022 Modernization of Cosmetics Regulation Act established new requirements for manufacturers and enforcement authority for the FDA. These conditions include requirements to report serious adverse events within 15 days, to register facilities with the FDA, and renew registrations every 2 years, and to list each marketed cosmetic product and its ingredients with the agency and provide annual updates. Cosmetic companies also have a legal responsibility to ensure their products' ingredients are safe, even as, quote, neither the law nor FDA regulations require specific tests to demonstrate the safety of individual products or ingredients, according to the FDA. So, the federal government really does have limited regulation. The fact that it's legal required that it's safe, but you don't actually have to do specific tests to demonstrate the safety or the efficacy, isn't very good teeth for regulation. So the fight continues. Way to go, California. Lead the way. Okay, well, let's switch gears and talk about chronic disease. This from MedPage Today. Arthritis is a massive public health problem. More than 20% of the American adult population has some form of arthritis during 2019 to 2021, according to CDC researchers, with the prevalence reaching nearly 50% for those aged 65 and older. Rates were even higher for people with other conditions such as dementia, stroke history, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. With some 53 million people affected, the public health implications are correspondingly massive, the researchers suggested. Because physical activity is well recognized as both preventing arthritis and reducing its impact when it does occur, clinicians and communities should do more to encourage everyone to exercise. Maintaining a healthy weight, engaging in sufficient physical activity, and avoiding joint injury are important for prevention. So this is another good example where comorbidities, having other conditions, is actually associated with, in this case, arthritis. Now, this is not probably because these other conditions cause arthritis. They probably have underlying causes that are actually driving both conditions. But in this case, for arthritis, if someone has dementia, they have a 2.6 time greater chance of having arthritis. That's 48% prevalence versus like about 19%. For chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, 2.5 times likely to have arthritis. For stroke, 2.1 times more likely to have arthritis. For those who have diabetes, a 60% greater chance of having arthritis. Social determinants also made an appearance in the report. People with high incomes, that is more than 400% of the federal poverty level, had arthritis prevalence of 16% compared to 25% among participants making less than 125% of the poverty level. So that means impoverished folks have a 60% greater chance of having arthritis compared to, quote, high incomes. Military veterans also had higher rates than non-vets at 24% versus 19%, about a 30% greater chance. That was to be expected insofar as veterans were more likely to suffer injuries that predisposed to arthritis. And finally, as well, women were more likely than men to have arthritis, at 21% versus 16%, about a 30% greater chance. Okay, well, I'd like to close the regular reporting of this show on a very interesting story that gets how being disconnected from nature can lead to, in this case, mental health problems. Medical Express. Largest ever study on light exposure proves its impact on mental health. The world's largest study on light exposure and its impact on mental health, with almost 87,000 participants, has found that increased exposure to light at night increases a person's risk for psychiatric disorders such as anxiety, bipolar, and PTSD severity, as well as self-harm. Importantly, the study also found that increasing exposure to daytime light can act like a non-pharmacological means for reducing psychosis risk. In those exposed to high amounts of light at night, the risk of depression increased by 30%, while those who were exposed to high amounts of light during the day reduced their risk of depression by 20%. Similar patterns of results were seen for self-harm behavior, psychosis, bipolar disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and PTSD. These findings indicate that the simple practice of avoiding light at night and seeking brighter light during the day could be an effective, non-pharmacological means of reducing serious mental health issues. And our findings were consistent when accounting for shift work, sleep, urban versus rural living, and cardiometabolic health. Humans in modern industrialized times have literally turned our biological systems upside down. Our brains evolved to work best with bright light in the day and then with almost no light at night. Humans today challenge this biology, spending around 90% of the day indoors under electric lighting, which is too dim during the day and too bright at night compared to natural light and dark cycles. It is confusing our bodies and making us unwell. And another layer on top of that, it's artificial light doesn't have the same wavelengths. It has similar effects. So light is important for resetting our biological clocks and waking us up in the morning. And obviously the pollution at night disturbs sleep. And obviously this great large study shows that it impacts mental health profoundly. Okay, well, that brings us to the final segment of the show, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 27 bonus articles this week. First up, why Gaza healthcare facilities and workers have suffered so much violence. So this is a good overview, and it's a little more directly health-focused since it's looking at healthcare facilities. But I must say, genocide is a public health issue, and it's not good. The second bonus article is Israeli health minister instructs public hospitals not to treat Hamas members, which is a specific example as far as healthcare. When you refuse to treat people, which, of course, if you're considering a war, is a violation of the Geneva Codes, you know, the so-called laws of war. But even worse than that, Israel in this case has actually refused to differentiate civilians from combatants by claiming that the entire civilian population they're at war with are Nazis or whatever. And that, what do you know? If everybody is a combatant, you can't have non-combatant deaths. A great logic, but also flawed and not in accordance with international law. In fact, killing civilians and targeting hospitals and doing collective punishment to entire populations is a war crime, not good for public health. Bonus article 3. First large study of hair relaxers among black women finds increased risk of uterine cancer. So I've reported on this before, hair care products specifically used by black women, in this case hair relaxers, has been shown to have a bunch of health issues. But we have actually a follow-up story on that, bonus article 4. FDA plans to propose ban on hair straightening chemical products linked to health risks. So this is coming right out of the gate. It's on their agenda to propose a ban. So that's actually fairly, there's been in the last few years, a lot of research on this, and glad to see that the FDA is going to make a response to that. Bonus article 5, Roundup herbicide ingredient connected to epidemic levels of chronic chronic kidney disease. So this is one that we've really learned in third world countries, particularly glyphosate, which is in the ingredient in Roundup, that supposedly it's supposed to break down in a day or a couple weeks, but when it's exposed to hard water or soil, it can last for up to for years. And this is causing these epidemics around the world, particularly places that have like hard water. When it gets into the water, it doesn't actually break. It forms these insoluble complexes, and it's still poisonous. So this is causing chronic kidney disease, kidney failure. There's communities where like 10% of the kids have chronic kidney disease because they're drinking water that's polluted with Roundup. Big problem. Bonus Article 6. 800,000 tons of radioactive waste from Pennsylvania's oil and gas industry has gone, quote, missing. Now, what this means, so this is basically fracking, fracking water and radioactive waste produced by the fracking industry in Pennsylvania and distributed to places to dump in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York. And what they do is they're required to register how much they produce, and then also they have to sign in, and the dumps and stuff will weigh how much waste, so there's a record of that. When you compare what they say, what they're producing, and what they're actually dumping, an 800,000-ton difference. So obviously not a very tightly well-regulated industry. Bonus Article 7. U.S. oil production hits all-time high, conflicting with efforts to cut heat-trapping pollution. So if you think fracking and drilling is going away, we have just hit the highest oil production in the U.S. ever. Yikes. Bonus Article 8. Corporate interests and the U.N. Treaty on Plastic Pollution, neglecting lessons from the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. So really what this is, a call to action that this WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control actually dealt with governance issues within the WHO and setting up tobacco control policies, that it's not subverted by corporate interests. And this needs to happen if we're going to address plastic pollution. In fact, it needs to happen if you're really going to address almost any problem which has corporate interests tied to it. And a somewhat related story, Bonus Article 9, leadership of patient advocacy organizations tied to pharma and device industry. So this is something I've noticed in, I don't know, like the last 5, maybe 10 years, that there's been this kind of divergence, that you look at these patient advocacy organizations related to like getting pharmaceuticals for, you know, Alzheimer's or rare diseases and all this kind of stuff. And it seems that a lot of times that advocacy is really outside the bounds of what would be considered safe and efficacious. But it turns out a lot of that is driven by the pharma industry that is funding and sending so-called experts to be on boards and to work with groups and stuff like that. So these patient advocacy organizations are not necessarily as grassrootsy as we would like. Okay, bonus Article 10, somewhat related. How to free ourselves from the scholar-activist dilemma. So this on the other end of it, a lot of time scholars, when they're doing things that qualify as activism, it's often considered a ding against their scholarly activity. I would argue, as somebody who has been accused of being a journalist and has hopefully a well-disclosed set of beliefs, values, framework. So, you know, if you disagree with me, hopefully you at least know what you're disagreeing with what I'm with. But I consider myself a scholar and practitioner, activist as well. But this is a good article that kind of covers some of those dilemmas and kind of gets at some of those critiques. We can be human beings and scholars and scientists as well. And part of being a human being, paying rent on this planet, is activism. Bonus Article 11. Incidence of lung cancer higher in women versus men aged 35 to 54. Kind of a sad mark of equity in that women now are actually more likely to die of lung cancer than men in these earlier age groups of 35 to 54. Not just because women are smoking more in recent decades. Bonus Article 12, misogyny in medicine impacts us all. So women healthcare providers and physicians actually perform better. are paid less, work harder, do higher quality work, we should respect that. Simple. It's a good article, though. Good overview. Bonus article 13. Medicare enrollees can switch coverage now. Here's what's new and what to consider. So I've talked a lot about Medicare Advantage, which is what all those ads that you see around. I say, unless you have a really, really, really good reason, I would stick to traditional Medicare. But you're going to be bombarded. And that brings us to bonus article 14. Scammy Medicare ads and unsolicited calls bombard seniors shopping for health insurance. Will federal efforts help them? I've talked about some new efforts by the feds to rein this in, which should help a bit, get rid of some of the worst as far as the TV ads. But the fact is, virtually all these ads, and of course these unsolicited calls that seniors get, are basically commercial insurance agents trying to sell a very limited product and are not, they're salespeople. They're not independent in the sense that they're there for your interest. They're trying to sell you a product. Bonus article 15. Insurers often shortchange mental health care coverage despite a federal law. The Biden administration is pushing insurers and state regulators to ensure that mental health care is treated like other care. So for over a decade, we've had so-called parity law where mental health and physical health are supposed to be covered the same, but we are very, very far from that. And the Biden administration is making some moves to push to make that actually a real thing. Bonus article 16. FDA warns of dangers in treating psychiatric disorders with ketamine. So this is just a simple reminder that ketamine is approved by the FDA not for psychiatric disorders, but as an anesthetic. And there is no FDA approval for any psychiatric disorder. It means there's not safety or effectiveness like dosage and stuff that's been figured out for psychiatric disorders. So just beware if you're using ketamine. It's not FDA approved if you're using it for psychiatric disorders. Bonus article 17. Illicit e-cigarettes flood stores as FDA struggles to combat imports. I reported on this a lot too, that these vaping e-cigarettes are largely illegal, but they're widely available because the FDA can't really keep up with enforcing it. Bonus article 18. The new vaccines and you. Americans better armed than ever against the winter blocks. So that just means that we basically have flu vaccines. We now have RSV vaccine, which is both for older adults and young kids. And of course, we have COVID vaccines. And in a good news bonus article 19, RSV vaccine maintains efficacy across two seasons in seniors. So this is something I'd been waiting to find out and hear about. So actually, if you get the RSV vaccine, you may only have to get it, for instance, every other season because it holds up pretty good over two seasons. So go ahead, you seniors, get that RSV vaccine. And bonus article 20, yes, everyone should get an updated COVID-19 vaccine. And there's eight reasons why in this article. Another good reason, bonus article 21. COVID might raise odds for immune disorders like Crohn's, alopecia. So we know that COVID increases the odds for a lot of conditions, but this study specifically looked at immune disorders. And we definitely know a lot of autoimmune disorders can be triggered by a COVID infection. So get your vaccines. Bonus article 22, Paxlovid antiviral cuts hospitalization death only in at-risk COVID patients with weak immune systems. So this is a Canadian study that looked at, you know, the real world of giving people Paxlovid, which is different than what's necessarily in the clinical trials. And unfortunately, it found that it really only was helpful for people at risk with weak immune systems. So if you're thinking about not getting the updated COVID-19 shots and just take Paxlovid if you get infected, it's actually, Paxlovid may not work as well as you want for many people. But bonus article 23, review estimates 69% three-dose vaccine efficacy against long COVID. So getting at least three doses of COVID vaccine has a 69% protection against long COVID compared to two doses or less. So getting additional doses helps. And long COVID is one of the things in the long game against COVID we need to worry about. Even if it's your, even if you've been infected once or twice, three times, four times, it helps. And sort of a Halloween story, not nearly as dangerous as COVID, but a little reminder as far as climate change. Bonus article 24. Rare flesh-eating bacterium spreads north as ocean warms. So this is one that hasn't been found up the eastern seaboard until recently, but as the ocean warms, we're seeing this flesh-eating bacterium make its move. Not anything I'd lose sleep over, but a good Halloween story. And lastly, I want to talk about Ohio issues coming up in the November election. Ohio issue one, right to make reproductive decisions, including abortion initiatives. So this just gives background and resources to make a judgment about how you want to vote. Of course, the appropriate public health thing would be to vote yes to secure reproductive rights in Ohio. And another article, bonus article 26, that gets at a lot of the misinformation that's going around, mostly on the anti-side of issue one. Ohio votes on abortion rights this fall. Misinformation about the proposal is spreading. So avoid that misinformation if you're curious about that, a good article. Bonus article 27, last but not least, Ohio issue 2, not quite as well advertised, an act to regulate adult use of cannabis. That is to decriminalize possession and to put a 10% tax on cannabis sales. Another good one to check out. So you can view these and all the other articles I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.